Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County's Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Jason WF2N will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder in as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's technical puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange-colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com into your browser. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just have the people point their browser at stream.kc2rc.com, and they can, too, listen to the audio stream. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name and your call sign and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide a cogent answer, and Jason WF2N will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment and, when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the net or our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net tonight, Jason WF2N. Good evening, Jason. Okay, good evening, Jason. A little bit noisy, so if you could raise the power output, that might help.
Okay, thanks, Roy. How's that?
A little bit better, but I don't know. I don't know if it's the repeater or the signal you're putting out. It's still about 20% noise in the background.
Okay, putting in full 50 watts now. How do I sound?
A little bit better. A little distortion on the audio again. I'm not sure if it's you or the repeater, but it sounds okay. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Technical Net. If you have any questions of a technical nature, please feel free. Any topics you want discussed, just give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am Net Control Operator for the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. The Technical Net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m., and this is the second Wednesday, so we are meeting. So if anyone out there has any technical questions, any topics they would like to discuss tonight, this would be as good an opportunity as any. So please give me your first name and your call sign.
A2NDB, this is Bob.
Bob recognized. Welcome aboard, Bob. Let me just ask if there's anyone else out there who wants to have their name on the list tonight for technical questions. If there is, just give us your first name and your call sign. Okay, very well. Bob, what's your question or topic tonight?
A2NDB, this is Bob. It's okay, it's a couple COVID questions. Back to you.
Yeah, sure, Bob. If you have some questions on the subject, I'll try my best to answer them for you.
while, but it's a little different than usual. And I have some slight shortness of breath, and it goes away. And right now, it's better than it was yesterday in the last few days. But I'm wondering whether to go in and get a test, because I'm worried about when I'm feeling good, I think the risk of exposure to a good test, and someone saying, you should stick it up your nose, there's a risk there, or, you know, that's a thing. There's a place near me called Go Health, and my own doctor thinks they're very good. And they're very nice on the phone. I've already postponed appointments twice because I felt better, and I said, maybe I won't take the risk of exposure. I don't know, it's asking for an opinion. That's all it is. And you can think of it as a general opinion about someone in that kind of situation. Back to you.
Well, Bob, and I was concerned because you mentioned something along these lines on Sunday night's Technical Net. I don't know. I tend to believe you're better to know things than not know them. And I understand that there is a non-zero risk of going into a place to be tested. I would hope that if it's a well-run, legitimate place, they have made all of the protective measures that are possible to limit risks to a very, very, very small amount. And so, especially since it's worrying you, and I can kind of tell that just by the tone of your voice, either you would know if it was COVID, or if it wasn't COVID, you probably would have more peace of mind about the symptoms that you're having. So I generally would err on the side of knowing more things than not.
Roy, thanks. And another thing, just like a worst-case scenario question, if it actually got to an emergency level for me or for anybody else, would you just call 911? I mean, to get to a hospital, I guess I'd have to do the ambulance thing, right? In my case, I was near the Methodist Hospital, the one that we meet in. So maybe I'd go there. Is there anything I should scope out ahead of time to know, like where to call or stuff like that, if it came to that? Back to you.
Well, I think thankfully the peak of activity has been over and through us weeks ago. I think the last time I looked at the death rate in New York City, it had dropped below 200, and that's an accomplishment, unfortunately, but it is an accomplishment. I think that the underlying thing is that all the emergency rooms are now no longer clogged. 911 is no longer going crazy. Ambulance services are relatively well manned and not overworked. So all the systems have pretty much, in New York City at least, returned to near normal. So I think 911 would not be a problem at this point. If you had asked me this 3 weeks ago, I would have answered differently about setting up all kinds of backup safety plans just in case. But the worst has come and gone in New York, and I hope it stays away. So I think you can rely on the usual methods, which would be, God forbid, if you need it, 911.
Thanks, Roy. Yeah, I think you probably unconfirmed something I already know, but I think even though I've had actually very mild symptoms, I mean, even mild for a cold, they're just a little different. So the worst symptom is the fear. It's kept me from sleeping a lot of the time. It's like, oh my God, the shoe could drop any time. So I'm assuming, even though I've been like five going into the sixth day of little or almost no symptoms sometimes, it could still happen. It's still a possibility. That's correct, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's a very varied virus. We kind of knew that from the very beginning when China was quoting that the period before you become obviously infectious goes anywhere from 4 days to 14 days after a person exposed to the virus. And the course is very varied. And unfortunately, the acceleration to a acute respiratory distress syndrome-like situation can take place in a matter of a few hours. So it can be very dangerous. But, you know, as I said before, I get the sense that probably just for your peace of mind alone, you would probably feel a lot better if you got yourself tested and demonstrated that it wasn't that, that, you know, maybe some other little minor virus or just a little bit of this, that, or the other. I mean, everyone kind of double takes any symptoms these days. If you get a little bit of a muscle twitch, you're worried about pleurisy, and you know, it's normal. It's the way we all deal with stress. So, like I said before, I think that it would be reasonable if you wanted to get yourself tested and demonstrate that you're not at risk for complications and then sleep sounder.
Thanks, Roy. I guess if I find out I'm positive, then I just know. And maybe I know with a get-out-of-jail-free card, but that's not even completely definite. But yeah, I have an appointment for tomorrow at 4:50. They're very cool. I've actually postponed, canceled, and then rescheduled twice, and they're just totally cool about that. Seems, I guess, other people may be doing this kind of thing, too, when they're hemming and hawing about it. So anyway, that's probably all I have for the moment. I hope some radio questions come in. Maybe I'll think of one. So, back to you. Thanks, Roy.
Okay, I hope everything turns out well. Just out of curiosity, does this facility use the 5-minute test, or does it require more time to get the results from them?
Well, this is the swab, and what's funny, they say 5 to 7 days, unfortunately. Maybe I should have gone in Monday. That's when I originally had a scheduled thing. But my doctor, who seems to know about this organization, he thought they were very good. He says, nah, they do it usually do it by 48 hours. It's like they kind of just say that so you won't complain about them being late or something. So at least 2 days, maybe 5 to 7 days, and it's a swab.
Yeah, most of the tests use a swab. There's a saliva test that's been approved by the FDA, but most of them are a cotton swab that's introduced all the way to the back of your nasal cavities and rolled around a little bit. And there's two methods. One is the 5-minute, where they just do the test internally. And the other is where they send it out to the local laboratories and they do the test. So that's the one that takes a few days to get back. So, okay, I hope it all turns out well and you can move on from worries about this in the future.
Troy, I actually talked to another guy who's in Virginia. I talked to him on Zoom. He went through all this, and he had tested. They handed him the swab and told him how to swab himself. I don't know if this place does it. They probably don't. I guess the advantage is there's not someone standing next to you. The disadvantage is you might not be doing it right because you're not trained to do it. So yeah, this is my last comment.
Yeah, Bob, I wouldn't go along with that at this present time because most people really do not want to stick a Q-tip that far back into their nose. A lot of people don't realize that the nasal cavity goes that far back. So most likely people who are left to do it themselves without significant training is going to lead to a lot more false negatives than if a technician does it. So my guess would be that the technician will place the Q-tip in its proper place when you're tested.
Okay, so I guess I'll just take a chance with this technician who's been around a lot of sick people being close to me. But they said they do all the cleaning. I mean, we do it individually, no waiting room stuff. We wait outside, and they pull you in right at the moment they do it, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so I guess that's about it. Thanks, Roy.
You're welcome, Bob. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am net control operator for the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Net. It meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m., and this is the second Wednesday of the month, and so we are meeting. So if you have a question of a technical nature or a scientific nature or anything that kind of touches upon technology or science and you want to throw it out and see what you get back, then please give us your first name and your call sign. Hello, William. How are you doing today? You have a question?
I have a technical question to ask
you. Okay. Once again, a lot of noise in the background. I think part of it is the repeater for some reason. Part of it might be from your transmitter. So if you're using a handy talkie, you might want to move the antenna around just a little bit one way or the other, or if it's a base station and you can put the power up a little bit higher, give it a try.
Better. I just moved the antenna.
Okay, that's much better, William. You know, sometimes people select the antenna for their reception, which is all well and good, but because there's a slight difference between the receiving frequency and the transmitting frequency, sometimes the best location for reception isn't generally the best location for transmission. But you're sounding much better now.
That's really good to hear. You're ready for the technical question now?
Yes, I am, William. Let her run.
We have got a comment. SVB-7 dual-band mobile antenna, and I put it together and stuff, and there's a problem because the second element doesn't actually fit down inside the shaft far enough, and so the set screw that's supposed to hold it in, I took it all the way out, and it's the shaft still doesn't go down inside there. And so then I stood around with it long enough to lose the set screw. So I just put it there, and it's just sticking in there, but it's not tight. And what I'm wondering is if that's actually a bad thing or if it can just stay like that.
Well, I'm not familiar with that exact model. Generally speaking, I would think that tight connections are the sturdiest and long-lived. One of the banes of just about everyone's existence are intermittent problems where these things will kind of pop up and they'll pop out, and it's very difficult to kind of figure out what they are if you already have other intermittent problems because the connections are not tight. You might want to contact the company and see what they have to say. Maybe it was a faulty unit that you got. For some strange reason, I've been talking to people who've been ordering things through HRO, which is a very reputable store, and having to send them back because there were microphones that didn't work, there were 10-meter antennas that didn't work, so this might be a deluge of not terribly well-made, quality-assured products coming out in the last month or two. So at the very least, I would contact either the retail outlet you bought it from or the manufacturer, because you probably would want one that's really kind of sturdy rather than one that might fail you at any moment.
Roy, I totally agree with you on all that, but the fact of the matter is the shaft doesn't go down past a certain point. It's like a collar inside. I'm going to call these guys tomorrow. I just got it today. And, you know, you're excited to put it together and it doesn't work. So it's the old Christmas Eve tricycle thing. But it's good to know that it at least transmits.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes things can be kludged together and work. You know, some radios are more forgiving than other radios as far as impedance mismatches and intermittent open or short circuits and such. But you know, you're working on luck at this point. It's always good to work on something a little bit more stable than just luck, because good luck could turn it into bad luck all of a sudden. And you might end up with a piece of equipment that the magic smoke escapes from. So I'm glad to hear that it's working for the time being. There might be something that fell into it that jammed the ability to lower it completely into the threaded area. You know, who knows? It could be a damaged thread that's blocking its drop down into the proper place. But like I said before, I mean, theoretically, I would just kind of contact the retailer. If it's a legitimate, good retailer, they'll just swap you out an old with a new, and you don't have to go to the trouble of talking to the guys at Comet, who, you know, they might send you some parts, they might send you another one. You never quite know. But who did you buy it from?
I got it from R&L. They seem like they're pretty smart. I'm going to call them tomorrow.
Yeah, they're a legitimate company. I would, if I were you, I'd contact them tomorrow and explain the details. And, you know, it's part of doing business. They'll pack it up and they'll send it back to Comet, and Comet will figure out if they want to reuse the bits and pieces into another unit or not. But, you know, I mean, if you have something and it kind of breaks over time, then you're kind of stuck and you kludge it as best you can. But a brand new shiny antenna, it should work out of the box. So I'm sure they'll be able to help you on this.
Your suggestion about the possibility of there being a burr in the channel is probably very accurate. And I can slip a thinner part down in there, but I can't see inside. So probably I get a little drill bit. I'll be able to just get that in and see if I can ream the hole a little. And that should, I don't like to send stuff back. So, but I think the idea about looking for, because when they tap holes, they just tap it and then they're done and they walk off and the next guy puts the screw in and then they put it in the package. So I think the thing is that's what they did, and they didn't deburr the inside of the hole. And that's probably what my problem is. So I thanks for the big tip, and I'll let you know another day how this turns out.
Okay, very good, William. I wish you good luck on all this, and then please tell us how the story ends. So this is, once again, AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am the net control operator for the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Net. It meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. And this being the second Wednesday of May, it's time to do technical stuff. So if you have any technical questions or science topics or such that you would like to ask and throw out, and we'll try our best to answer them. So all you need to do is give us your first name and your call sign. Okay, maybe we'll jump to the TechNet puzzle for tonight. As I mentioned before, you can either find the link on the front page, or you can just type in the URL of your web browser, puzzle.kc2rc.com, and it'll come up with the puzzle question. And the puzzle question is a schematic. Unfortunately, where I got the schematic from, they use the United Kingdom method of drawing schematics, in that rather than the zigzag line that we use for resistors, they use little rectangles. But nevertheless, it's a galvanometer, because we've been talking about meters in the past, and a full-wave rectifier bridge, and a series of switchable resistances in series with the meter. And the question is, which of the following can be measured by the moving coil meter in this diagram? So the choices are AC voltages or DC voltages. I mean, we're not even asking you to recognize that it's a design for a voltmeter. But the question is, does it measure both AC or DC? Does it measure only AC or only DC? Does it measure both? So that's the question for tonight in the puzzle. Anyone want to take a gander at it and tell me what they think the answer is?
William, AC2ZV, I'd like to chat on this, but maybe somebody else wants to jump in.
Okay, William, I'll ask again, and if no replies, then we'll chat about this. Anyone else want to jump into this TechNet puzzle tonight? Okay, I guess it's yours, William.
The question, I don't know if it was just my radio, but it suddenly dropped out. I only heard about half the question. And my computer, well, I'm rebooting it. I had a problem, and so I can't look at it at the moment.
Okay, Bob, hopefully you're hearing my signal. The question is, there's a schematic diagram, and the way it's drawn is there's a number of switchable resistors in series with a galvanometer, and the galvanometer is hooked up directly to a full-wave rectifying bridge. And so the question of that schematic is, which of the following can be measured by the moving coil meter in this diagram that I've just described? Your choices are DC voltages or AC voltages, but the A, B, C, D question that needs to be answered is whether it's neither AC or DC voltages that could be measured, AC voltages that could be measured, DC voltages that could be measured, or both AC and DC voltages that can be measured using a full-wave rectifier bridge, a galvanometer, and a number of switchable resistors in series.
Troy, I don't think I know the answer, so you should probably let the other station take it. I can take a wild guess, but I think he knows more about this.
Okay, very good, Bob. So you're on, William.
Well, for some reason, my phone had just died, and I can't get to the actual diagram you're talking about. But I really know a lot about these galvanometers because as a kid, that was the first electronic experiment I did.
Okay, then, you know, let it rip. This is I think in earlier puzzles we talked about when we could hook up in a galvanometer in series with a switchable resistor. That was a way of calculating, measuring DC voltages, because using Ohm's law with a known amount of full current deflection and knowing the resistance of the resistor, you can figure out what voltage would be required to have a full deflection of the galvanometer. So we've already kind of talked about how voltmeters use resistors and galvanometers. This little extra tickle is what happens when you connect the galvanometer not directly to that circuit, but through a full-wave rectifying circuit.
Well, okay, the phone came back, and I now see the exact diagram with a full-wave rectifier in the meter in the center, with the three resistors and the two terminals on it. You can measure both AC and DC with this meter and this arrangement because your DC is just going to go through in one direction and your AC will go through in both directions. But in either case, the meter is only going to see current going in one direction and so it will deflect appropriately. I don't know about any calibrations with these resistors, but depending on, you know, your voltage range of things and your deflection of the needle, you could use different resistors for different scales.
Yep, Bill. William, you're absolutely correct. The point of this exercise for people playing along is that if you didn't have the full-wave rectifier in the circuit, if it was purely the original circuit that we previously talked about of a galvanometer hooked up in series with a known resistance, you would detect the direct current. You would detect the voltage, the direct current voltage using such a configuration. Because the full current would be going in one direction, and it would deflect the galvanometer to a calibrated setting, and you'd get a number. The problem with the previous simpler circuit is if you had an alternating current voltage potential and you hooked it up to the older device, because the current would go back and forth with each cycle, the galvanometer's inertial mechanical design would dampen both of those movements right and left, and you'd be left with a galvanometer that falsely gave you basically zero voltage potential, even though it would be hooked up to, say, 120 volts of your utility voltage, and your galvanometer would probably burst into smoke, even as it reported that there was no voltage potential going on because it was getting alternating current. With the full-wave bridge, all of the alternating current becomes a current going in only one direction. So you don't have that problem with the galvanometer being jerked right and left. It's only deflected in one direction. And as long as we know what the current is at full deflection, what the resistance is, we can calculate the effective voltage potential, be it AC or DC. So the answer for this particular question on the puzzle is answer D, both A1 and 2, which is both DC voltage and AC voltage, can be measured with this type of a voltmeter. So very good, William. That was the point of the exercise, and I hope people took away a little bit on that subject. And we'll be talking about rectifiers and half wave and full wave for our next TechNet puzzle in 2 weeks.
I just wanted to add a little bit to that. As it turns out, this when I got this, it was like 1959. And I got a secondhand book from the 40s that told me about electronic experimentation. And what they did was they had me go out and get some copper wire and wind it up around, make two coils, and I had to build a stand out of wood and dangle a silk thread with a magnetized needle over it. And then it was so sensitive it had to be aligned with north so that, you know, it wouldn't be automatically deflected. And then it was a whole series of experiments trying to figure out what resistance was and whether or not, you know, electricity from a battery did this or that or what happened. And it was, I don't know, I had to think for a while and then finally I broke it.
that's great. You didn't even have to buy yourself a galvanometer. You basically had the instructions to build your own galvanometer. I never quite got to that point. I played around with some galvanometers. I played around with some crystal radio sets when I was a little kid. But that sounds like it was a better experiment to make your own galvanometer.
Well, I was stuck out in the country with absolutely nothing to do and no materials whatsoever, and this was at least something I could do. And, you know, me getting my hands on a meter would have been, you know, well, I probably could have got it from the airbase or something. But being able to make my own was kind of really exciting. But even though it was seemed very, very funky at the same time, that this was all there was with such a simple, you know, stuff like, you know, cardboard tubes and wax and electrical wire. And, you know, that's it. That was what all electronics was made out of.
Yeah, in the old days, I think it made a lot more sense than it does now. Now, unfortunately, to too many people, electronics have become a kind of black box where signals go inside this little plastic thingy and signals come out another pin out of that thingy, and they try not to consider solid-state gates and all kinds of magic that goes on inside the black box. And unfortunately, I think that kind of takes a little bit away from the fun that we used to have discovering how electronics works.
Electronic meters are certainly different than Darsan's valve movement meters, you know, and so you, when you take electronic meter apart, it's just a bunch of circuit boards and crap. But if you take the Darsan valve meter apart, you get like bearings and springs and coils and cool stuff like that. So, you know, it's amazing how things have transitioned from stuff we know to stuff we absolutely don't know.
Well, I don't know. I think that's the nature of things. We start with stuff that makes sense to us, and then little by little we discover these things that really don't make a great deal of sense. I mean, sit people down and explain solid-state physics and how transistors work and the concept of holes in semiconducting crystalline doped material, and you'll give some people a headache. Other people will enjoy it, but other people get a headache. You talk about springs, you talk about coils, you talk about needles, and just about everyone sort of gets what you're talking about. I mean, one of the strangest times I had when I was a little kid, I used to take apart everything to figure out what made it run. And capacitors made some sense to me, and inductors made some sense to me, and even in a way, vacuum tubes made some sense to me. But for the life of me, I could not figure how transistors worked. It just looked like people had stuck a little bit of steel wool on a grain of sand, and that was it. And yet it did magical things. And at that age, I was just completely confused by semiconductors.
Well, yeah, I totally agree with that. It's just phenomenal. You just buy it by part number, and you don't really know what it is. Even tubes, you could buy it by part number, but you could look inside, and you'd see the grids and everything in there. So, you know, you thought you knew what was going on to a certain extent. I think that one of the things that started me was germanium diodes that we used in the first crystal sets. So exciting to hear that you're going to bring this up on one of the tech nets coming up.
Yes, the famous 1N34A. I still have some of those in a parts bin. I think all hams should at least have a couple of 1N34As sitting around someplace.
Well, I had this cat's whisker deal, and we would be playing around with it, and then it would lose the station, and you'd just go around with it to find another spot that would work. And, you know, so one day I was at my friend's house, and we were playing with this thing, and his brother walked in and says, "Hey, you know what? You just use this thing, and you don't have to play with it anymore." And so he wired it up for me, and lo and behold, we could listen to the radio. But that took a lot of fun out of it.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, you know, there are some times where you just need to get work done. So having something that consistently works without having to fidget it is a plus. But it still gives you a big gee whiz moment when you find out how a lot of different things, like I saw a YouTube where they take basically a corroded 1 pence piece, and they use it as a nonlinear device to act as the detector for a crystal set. I find that fascinating. I wouldn't risk anyone's life on that technology, but I still find it fascinating nevertheless.
Common materials that, you know, you do around the house. I had my first crystal radio set, you know, we made a toilet paper roll and wound it up, and it was a variable inductor, so the actual capacitor was made of tin foil and wax paper. You just rolled that up, but you could run a little metal, you know, runner back and forth across the coil, and that's what actually worked. But I had the dimensions for that at one point, you know, so much tin foil, such a tube, so much, you know, wire. But I think that would be a really cool thing that maybe we could do as an experiment, you know, which wouldn't require any soldering at all.
Yeah, it certainly would. I've seen these experimental, not quite kits, but they're more of presentations in books, because you supply most of the stuff yourself, and some of it's amazing. And what kind of a headset did you use for your crystal set? I tended to find that's the Achilles heel. If you had access to a very cheap, high impedance piezoelectric earpiece, you were able to hear things that other lower impedance type of headsets wouldn't really let you get away with.
Sure, that was the magical part of it. It came from a hearing aid, and I was told it was a crystal headset. I don't think it was piezoelectric, but it was like this flesh-colored, tan thing with a clear plastic end on it, with a really gimpy little wire and a single jack on the end. And it would put out a pretty good output. So I don't know if it was a crystal or if it was a piezo. Do you have any idea about that? We said it was a crystal headset.
Well, I think they tended to use these things interchangeable. The piezoelectric effect usually is from crystals. You can have it go in one direction, like a crystal calibration frequency for an oscillator, in which you are exciting the oscillations with an electrical signal in frequencies that aren't audible, but you can just as easily, if you have the right type of a crystal, oscillate it in audio frequencies, and it becomes a piezoelectric earpiece. They were kind of generically the earpieces that you, if you ever bought a transistor radio in the early 60s, they threw in the cheapest piezoelectric earpiece that very tinny, I found them personally. But again, they were very high impedance, and they worked great on crystal radio sets.
I agree. It's very, very tinny frequency response. I would think the element was very small in diameter and couldn't move much air, but it probably gave like maybe 900 to 3,000.
Well, I don't know. At that point, I don't think I even thought that much about the audio spectrum. I just thought it was all fascinating that you could hear stuff with little bits and pieces of things, rather than a transistor radio that you had to go out and buy. So I always have found radio and electronics in general to be rather magical. And I think that's one of the kind of universal themes of many hams, that when they were growing up, just the idea of radio waves getting all over the place and being invisible and undetectable by our human senses is something that attracted us all to this hobby.
I totally agree, because one thing about the crystal set, it was much better at night, and you could get lots of different stations that you never could get during the day.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was kind of the beauty of AM radio. When nighttime fell, you could get these distant high-power stations propagating all across the coast, and that was also fun. There were people who were kind of into DXing AM radio broadcasts.
Looking for good rock and roll stations.
Well, I don't know. I tended to listen to more to Gene Shepherd and Long John Neville and those guys on the radio at night.
I think if I could have found interesting stories, I probably would have listened to them. But most everything that was on just seemed like it was just music. And a lot of it I didn't care for that much. But I liked rock and roll back in the early 60s. It was great.
Well, that was the time for it. It's still alive and well to a degree. I'm sort of surprised that you never, I don't know where you grew up. In New York, Gene Shepherd was an institution. He was a great storyteller. He went on to Hollywood to write a Christmas story, and he used to be on WOR every night, every weeknight, and he was a ham himself. He was a very strange ham in that most of the time he was more of a CW operator. He didn't really, I don't think, do that much phone, and for some reason he identified himself by his middle name, Parker, when he was on the ham bands, as opposed to his name known to most of us, Gene Shepard. But he would tell stories about how he went to the FCC office in I forget where it was, some place in the Midwest, and got his ticket. He had to draw a Colpitts oscillator complete with component values, and you know, that was going on out at WOR radio at night. So it was loads of fun to listen to Gene Shepard back in the good old days.
That's really fun. I was overseas quite a bit when I was younger, and so I missed out a lot of what happened here in the States. And I had, as I grew older, I got a shortwave, and I listened to BBC and Voice of America and stuff like that. But I didn't have the same kind of thing. And I liked the stories, but I didn't, it wasn't that kind of stories, you know. It was all Americana, America's the greatest place, etc.
Yeah, I mean, there are guys, there are shortwave listener guys who used to love listening to the Voice of America. There were countercultures group guys who were busy listening to the Soviet Union or Communist China's English broadcast. I don't know. I found it amusing. I found it interesting at times, but I kind of landed upon the ham bands and kind of got fascinated by the pretty much technical conversations people were having on the lower bands at that time in the 60s. So I found a lot of interesting conversation on the ham bands. There wasn't any kind of political nonsense. It was kind of technical, and that was, to me, fun at the time. But, you know, different strokes for different folks.
I think I would have liked those kind of things, but they just weren't out there for me. But certainly it's great talking to you tonight, Roy, and I guess I'll give it back to you, Net Control.
Likewise, William. Always a pleasure. Well, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am net control operator for the Kings County Radio Club's technical net that comes on every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 9 p.m. So if anyone has any questions of a technical nature, topics they want to discuss, please feel free. Hit that push-to-talk button and give us your first name and your call sign. Okay, we'll give it one last time before we call it a night. I am AC2GS, Roy, net control operator of the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If you have any questions or topics tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign.
This is William again. I got a quick question.
Yeah, sure, please. What's your question?
Yeah, I got this SMC34 push-to-talk mic speaker thing, which is really cool, and I think it works pretty good. But I'm wondering what you would think about it. So I'd like to do a little test where I unplug it and then try to talk to you with the radio and then see what you think the difference is.
Sure, let her rip.
Okay, so this is the SMT34 push to talk going in the side of the radio, and I'm going to cut out. This is the radio itself. I'm talking to you. I don't really hear a response back, but I'm talking to you through the radio itself, and so that's the end of the test.
Okay, the radio itself, the built-in mic, I guess what it is it has a lower gain than your external mic. So it sounds like it's something along, I don't know, four decibels lower than the hand mic. There's some audio differences, obviously. The separate mic is maybe a little on the hot side, so it's kind of bassy. I think if it was lower intensity, the bassiness would probably fade. But the in-radio microphone has a lower gain, and it's a little bit on the thin side.
Looks like I'm a satisfied customer. I like the way this thing feels in my hand so much better than holding the handy-talkie. It's so much better.
Yeah, I mean, I bought separate hand mics for my handy-talkies as well. I mean, I guess if you're out and about, it one less piece of equipment is a better thing. I just like the touch of a hand mic's push-to-talk. Usually, you never get the same feel from a handy-talkie, at least I don't.
So I also got a headset, and now that we've gotten between the difference between the mic and the regular radio mic, I'd like to plug in a headset and see what you have to say about that, if it's okay.
Sure, let her rip.
Okay, so this is the push-to-talk mic speaker, Kenwood thing, and I'm going to unplug it and then come back on the headset. Push-to-talk button, and probably the mic was in an okay place right now, so in general, how good it sounds, and how does it compare?
Yeah, the gain on that microphone element is very low. It's an easy 6 decibels lower than your hand mic, and there's a kind of background hum that's not attenuated, so I hear a nice strong hum, probably 60 cycle, I guess, and a very, very thin, underdriven voice from that microphone.
Well, that's kind of disappointing. I kind of like this headset. But anyway, I'll go back to the other thing, and just for the final comparison, then I'll sign off. Okay, back on the speaker mic, and anyway, thanks so much for entertaining me with this, Roy. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, William, anytime. And if you want to hear what it sounded like to me in about 5-10 minutes, I'll post the archive audio from my shack, and you can listen to your signals and come to your own conclusions if you want.
Sounds like a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. Thanks for a great NetNet, Roy. Have a great evening. Back to Net Control. AC2, Zulu Victor, out.
Okay, very good, William. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am Net Control Operator for the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. And we're here on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. until people run out of questions. So once again, before I wrap it up for tonight, I will give people a final opportunity if they have any questions or topics that they want to discuss tonight before the TechNet calls it a night. Please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign. Very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesdays of each month. Our next meeting will be June 3rd, which will be held by teleconferencing. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Our regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. On this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater. If you can communicate using Fusion Digital technology, please join in. You can connect to our repeater while in Fusion Digital mode, either directly using Fusion Digital technology radios or by using a hotspot in some other digital technology mode using our network gateways, such as our XLX server. We offer an audio stream of the FusionNet on the Internet, as well as all audio transmissions on our club repeater that can be found by just typing into your browser stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is easily available on our website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. And we are still stuck in the middle of our little coronavirus problem, so please, everyone, treat it with the proper respect and seriousness. Don't panic, because that doesn't get you anywhere, but don't make believe it ain't there, because that'll get you into more trouble. So just be safe continue to follow the rules that health specialists have offered us all. And as the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen more and talk less. We'll be rolling this up and shutting it down for now, but we'll be back to do it all over again May 27th, and you're all welcome to join us. So my thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and especially to Jason, WF2N. Without you guys, I would just be talking to myself. So this is Roy AC2, GS, going clear, and getting the heck out of here. Stay safe, guys. Until next time.